Okay. All righty. Three, two, one. Well, they said it wouldn't last, whoever they are, but welcome to episode 100 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician, professor at the University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice, and happy to be here for our 100th reunion.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, another family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We're recording a little bit later than usual, in part because at least three of us have had some extensive travel. And Mark, you just got back from Italy, and hopefully you are well rested from that. We've really enjoyed doing these podcasts and want to thank all of our listeners for their intermittent feedback and comments.
Thanks, Henry. And on this podcast, we highlight poems, patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want all of them, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. You get a poem daily, all 230 or 50 a year, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters, mostly written by and for primary care physicians and subspecialty experts. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit from the IAFP. Go to IAFP.com, click on their education webpage, and find our podcast. So this week, a little bit different. We're going to discuss some of our favorite studies since episode one, well over 2 years ago, almost well over 3 years ago, I think. That includes bedtime dosing of blood pressure medicines, drinking beer before wine or wine before beer, aspirin for primary prevention, and asthma diagnosis. Kate is going to start us off.
Right. And I, of course, have not been here since the beginning. So thanks for having me in partway through. But I decided to go back to the beginning anyways. I had several choices for the poem I wanted to highlight on this occasion. I thought about picking things that I thought were like major changes from the past few years, like the first studies about COVID, the major SGLT2 cardiovascular studies. And then I thought about like things that are going to, I think, are going to like change practice in the future, like poly pills, because I think they're fascinating. But instead, I'm going to go with the Hygieia study, because if I think it's true, it's genius. But the skeptic in me is also not completely sure it isn't too good to be true. So it's like the best of both worlds. John first presented this study in episode 36, but there are actually two earlier studies from the same authors that were published about 10 years ago. So this isn't new, and I love it as a cheap, simple, effective, immediately implementable, and high consequence change. If you have been to any of our live courses in the past like 7 or 8 years, you've heard me talk about these studies because I really do just think they're fascinating. Anyway, in this study, the researchers asked whether bedtime ingestion versus morning dosing of antihypertensive medications produced better cardiovascular disease risk reduction in adults with high blood pressure. So they identified about 19,000 adults who met just standard blood pressure criteria, hypertension criteria, and then they randomized them to either take all of their antihypertensives in the morning versus at least one of them at nighttime. That was it. That was the whole study. And then they followed them for about 6 years. The patients got regular blood pressure lowering medications, ARBs, ACEs, calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, or diuretics. They had sort of a standard algorithm for how they got the medications, sort of in what order. All of the patients got statins, aspirins, diabetes medications as needed. And then both the individuals and the researchers were masked as to both treatment assignment and as well as outcomes. So there was a separate group that was assessing outcomes. Their primary outcome was major adverse cardiovascular events, MACEs, MIs, coronary revascularization, heart failure, stroke, cardiovascular death. Again, about a six-year follow-up. They had incredibly accurate follow-up, about 99% of participants. And what they found is that people who were taking at least one of their antihypertensives at night had a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. So the adjusted hazard ratio is 0.55, which is a tremendous difference when you think about what the change actually was. Again, just taking at least one of their pills at night. Number needed to treat was therefore about 20. Adverse effects were similar in both groups. Adherence was, they said poor adherence was only 3% in both groups, which seems just astonishingly small, even for people who are in a trial. So very small change with potentially big results. Henry, do you believe it?
Henry, you're muted. And that's my fault. Let me just catch you. There was some sniffling. I think you might have some allergies, and it was kind of a loud, sniffy noise. And so, and you have the most sensitive mic, so we were picking this up pretty regularly.
Sorry.
So that's why I muted you. You may just want to mute yourself in between. So
anyway, I will do that.
I thought I could unmute you in time, but it wouldn't let me unmute you once I muted you.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
All right. 3, 2, 1. I don't know that I believe it or not, but I don't care because this is so cheap and so simple to implement. In some ways, it's nice because, as you pointed out, the other studies, these actually show there's physiologic data that shows that in a fair number of persons with hypertension, that there are nocturnal rises in aldosterone and blood pressure, and this actually results in a really nice pairing. The fact that mortality is improved is even more important. This is a study that is not without controversy, and I'll let John talk a little bit about that controversy, but I did enjoy the fact that this is, the name is called chronotherapy, this process of changing timing of things, and that one of the journals is in Chronobiology International. I've actually been doing this myself, and the only problem that I have, if even using my phone alarm, is that I still miss occasionally a 10:30 p.m. dose because I've already gone to bed and the phone is downstairs. So, John, tell us about the controversy that you encountered.
Yes, the controversy. This was not embraced wholeheartedly by the cardiology community internationally. And there was some hot debate in a couple of journals about this particular study. I had the opportunity to review that debate because we were publishing something about it in our Journal of Family Practice. And I read the response from the authors to all of the critique. And I thought the authors responded to every single item, every single objection to the study. So yes, I have to say I am a believer and I tell all of my patients with hypertension to do this.
Yeah, I'll second that. And, you know, I'm in my N of one trial. I'm on a lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide combination and I split them up and I started taking the same dose of lisinopril at night. And my blood pressure was far lower, in fact, low enough that I had to cut the dose in half to avoid passing out in the middle of the night. I'm one of those nighttime dippers that John mentioned. So, you know, there is it's simple, it's free. It's a way of actually reducing blood pressure more, perhaps by using less medicine or the same medicine rather than having to add another medicine as in some other trials. So, I'm all on board for this. Henry, can you give us the quiz?
Yes. So in honor of the 100th anniversary, I decided to talk about poems because these are the primary source for our podcasts. So the question is, which of the following statements about poems is true? A, the poets are all family physicians. B, the poets exhaustively search PubMed and other databases each month. C, the idea for poems was born in a bar. D, since the very beginning, each poem has been peer-reviewed. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Henry. I think I know the right answer to that one, but we'll see. Hey, I want to answer, but anyway, Henry, speaking of ideas born in a bar, why don't you tell us about our next poem?
Yeah, so this is a study that we talked about a couple of years ago, and I like this for a variety of reasons. One, it's pragmatic. Two, it's sort of a myth buster. And there actually shows that you can actually apply reasonably rigorous research methodology around a fun topic. So this asks the question, does consuming wine before beer really cause more hangovers than consuming beer before wine? And this was by Kuchling in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2019. 2019. This was a really nifty randomized crossover trial that tried to evaluate this folk wisdom that consuming wine before beer will trigger more hangovers. So this was a multinational authors, but the study took place in Germany, placed near and dear to Mark and my heart. The participants were adults 18 to 60. They were physically fit and previously were consumers of alcohol. And they identified 105 individuals. And what they did was each participant was given two matching partners based on age, sex, height, body mass index, alcohol consumption, hangover frequency. So these are your drinking buddies, if you will. And what they got was a bunch of free beer from Carlsberg. There was no funding for this study other than the free beer that was presumably just used in the study itself and not by the researchers. And they used a white Qualitätswein, a table wine, that was chilled to about 40 degrees centigrade, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And then they rolled the dice. So drinking and gambling just seems to be appropriate. And so what happened was that each, when they rolled the dice to randomize the individuals to one of three treatment groups, if you will, and I'll say a little bit more about the treatment groups in a little bit. So what happened was that the first weekend, everybody got randomized to the one treatment, and then the second weekend, they got this alternate treatment, if you will. So there was a one-week interval in between. Now, the three groups, there was a control group. So they only consumed beer or wine the first weekend, and then wine or beer the second weekend. Second control group consumed beer until they reached a breath alcohol level of 0.05, and then they switched over to wine until they had a blood alcohol level of 0.11. Okay, so, and then, so they can just see the alternate process there for the other groups then. And what was really cool was that they all had a babysitter or a chaperone or a hall monitor. They were kept overnight. They were given a standardized meal that was based on caloric needs, based on body mass index and gender. And then the next morning, if their breath alcohol levels were down to zero, they then administered a hangover scale, and then they could go home. What did they find? Well, it turns out that regardless of which group that they were in, the hangover severity scores were the same. So it didn't really matter whether or not the order of consuming fermented beverages or not. Now, this is also another example of how you can actually create a career in research. They didn't study cocktails or just straight distilled spirits, so that could be the next set of studies that these people do. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, so that is, I think, an overly complicated way to study a relatively simple problem. And John, we're going on a sailing trip this summer in the Chesapeake Bay, and I propose we do a pragmatic trial where we simply have, two beers followed by two glasses of wine, or three and three, or whatever, and we will do a visual analog headache scale in the morning. So that's my father Herbert from Berlin said, "Wein before Bier, das rate ich dir. Bier vor Wein, lass es sein," which means wine before beer, I recommend. Beer before wine, leave it alone. So with that, Kate, any comments on our alcohol-fueled study here?
Yeah, I don't think they quite they studied the extremes quite right. So it says that the hangover scale, which probably has some hilarious acronym that we didn't mention, that the scores went from 0 to 56, 56 being the worst, but that the participants only had hangover severity scores with a range of 10 to 25, which seems kind of mild at best. So I think to Henry's point about maybe they could repeat this, I don't think that they drank enough, to really assess whether this is, that seems the only obvious conclusion. It wasn't even half, like the average or the worst possible hangover score reported wasn't even half of what the scale goes up to. So I don't think we really know. I think that
they needed a blood alcohol level of 0.2.
Yeah, that's I mean, really, to really assess. So for now, I think we stick with the folk wisdom. Okay. I think that there's so much folk wisdom, we're probably right here.
Okay, it's my turn. Something a little more serious. And this is from the Esprit trial. And this was a randomized trial in the New England Journal back in 2018. It was one of the earlier poems we covered. And this, the results of this trial were published in three articles in the New England, same article in the New England Journal. And around the same time, there were several other studies being published from other countries with somewhat different populations, but basically all identifying older, as in 50 and older persons, or 60 and older, or 70 and older, and randomizing them to aspirin, low dose, or no aspirin, or placebo, actually, for primary prevention. And so this was the report for the Esprit trial. Over 19,000 community-dwelling adults in the U.S. and Australia, they all got either a low-dose aspirin or placebo. This was an older population, but the other studies had somewhat younger populations or diabetic populations. They were all 70 or older. About half were women. About 10% were non-white. They had to have no serious comorbidity, so it was true primary prevention, no known heart disease, et cetera. Most of the patients came from Australia. 74% had hypertension, 65% had hyperlipidemia, 11% diabetes. So that's pretty similar to a comparable U.S. population, I think. They had a one-month placebo run-in period just to make sure they would take the medication, and they excluded about 20% of patients who they had originally tried to recruit because of that. They followed them for 5 years, and they had very few withdrawals. It was a simple study, you know, just take one pill a day. Only 2% were lost to follow-up. The main outcome was a composite of death, dementia, or physical disability, and that occurred almost exactly the same amount in both groups, hazard ratio 1.1. If anything, it was a teeny tiny bit higher in the aspirin group, but not significantly. Major hemorrhage, on the other hand, was more common with aspirin, about 8.6 versus 6.2 major bleeding events per 1,000 person years. So for every 100 people followed for 10 years, that's how I think of 1,000 person years, you'd have a couple more of these major bleeding events. They found increased all-cause mortality, mainly due to increased cancer-related mortality, which was statistically significant. There were about an extra 1.6 deaths, all-cause deaths per 1,000 person years. The other aspirin studies also found similar things where the benefits were muted, lower compared to, or you know, whatever fancy word you want to use, attenuated, that's my favorite word, compared to earlier studies. And we actually, with my colleague Frank Moriarty and I, we actually did a meta-analysis that was later published in the U.S. literature in JABFM. And we found when we combined the data from the newer studies and compared it with the older studies, the newer studies had the same amount of harm, but much less benefit. And I think hypothesized that that's because we do a much better job controlling cardiovascular risk factors right now than they did in the 80s or early 90s or even 70s. And they also were also screening for colorectal cancer. So we're going to reduce the incidence and mortality due to colorectal cancer now that we weren't doing back then. John, what do you think? Do you buy this getting away from aspirin for primary prevention?
I sure do. It's great to have a large study like this that I believe provides us with a definitive answer. That is, if you're over 70 and you do not have established vascular disease, there is no reason to take aspirin. In fact, there's reason to not take a daily aspirin. So great study.
Yeah. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. So we're talking about a shrinking population, right? Over 70, no vascular disease. I'd like to see the analysis and 9% non-white. This is a majority, 80s, almost 90% of the patients were in Australia. So better data on, patients of color would be nice to see if that's how that shakes out in a more diverse setting. But yeah, I mean, I think this the aspirin data has been a little bit slippery for a while. And so I think it's certainly moving in the direction of we have other better ways to do primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. I think that's really being embraced.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of a lesson for other things too, particularly around prevention, is that you have to look at what's going on around you, the context, how are we screening for disease? How are we trying to prevent disease? What other interventions have become common? And I think I disagree with the USPSTF on their most recent recommendation, they still dragged in all of these ancient studies and combined them with the newer studies, when I really think the most relevant data are from those four very large contemporary studies. And I think they give us a much more accurate picture of the current impact of primary prevention. So let's see here. Who is next? I think, John, we've got your poem coming up next.
Yes. It was kind of a tie for my favorite study between the Hygieia study that Kate presented and this one. I think she also loves a study too, by the way. The purpose of this study was to determine whether a diagnosis of current asthma can be ruled out and asthma medication stopped safely in a randomly selected a section of adults with physician-diagnosed asthma. This study took place in Canada, and they recruited folks from 10 Canadian cities by newspaper and other types of advertising and said, if you have a diagnosis of asthma that was made by your physician, please, we'd like you to sign up for this study. And so a lot of people signed up, and most of them, in fact, were included. They had about 1,000 people who signed up, and of those, 701 actually participated in the study. So a pretty representative cross-section of people with asthma. Now, they confirmed the diagnosis of asthma by asking their physicians. So these people indeed had a chart diagnosis of asthma. Okay, so these folks had asthma. So what did they do? What they did was they asked everybody to consider stopping your medications. Can you stop your medications safely? And what happens when you do stop your medications? So what happened was 613 of the 701 completed the study, pretty good. And current asthma was ruled out in 203 of the 613 study participants by means of pulmonary function testing, stopping medications, etc. What they found also was that 12 of these participants had serious cardiorespiratory conditions that had been misdiagnosed as asthma. So they picked up some cases that were being treated improperly. Okay, so they followed everybody for a year. What happened after a year? At the end of a year, there were still about 30% of the patients who had been taken off their medication still did not have any symptoms or lab evidence of asthma. So that is pretty amazing, I would say. The bottom line is that about a third of patients in this community-dwelling sample who were thought to have asthma by themselves and by their physician did not. And I think it's a great reminder for us all to consider reconsidering the diagnosis of asthma, especially in adults who are, say, non-compliant with their medication. Well, they may be non-compliant, non-adherent, because they don't need that medication. So it's time to retest and be sure whether your patients have asthma or not. Kate, what do you think?
I do love this study, as you know. There are many things that I like about it. So starting with, they did random digit dialing. You know, this was a Canadian study because they randomly called people's homes and they said, is there an adult in your home who has been diagnosed with asthma in the last 5 years? And they managed to find 1,000 people who said yes to that question. And I know that they do random digit dialing studies in the US, but it just seems very Canadian that they would manage to find 1,000 people to opt into that study instead of just 1,000 or more people who would just hang up on them or even to answer their phones. I think the biggest takeaways for me are the conclusions here. So as you mentioned, a number of people had other serious conditions. So you mentioned the cardiorespiratory conditions. There were other ones that were that were Mark's showing off his Canadian status. There were other serious conditions, not just the cardiovascular ones, but also sarcoid was on there. Other infectious, I think aspergillosis was also in there. So other things that were missed because people were diagnosed with asthma. And then the other takeaways were, if your patient was diagnosed with asthma and had not undergone PFT testing and was not currently on a controller, that those were the patients who were most likely to be found to have a diagnosis other than asthma. So just the conclusions from this study, which was complex, the steps that they went through to diagnose somebody without asthma, with a diagnosis other than asthma, was not simple. So they didn't undertake that lightly. So yeah, I agree. I love everything about this study. I just think it's genius on many levels. Henry?
Thank you. So diagnosis is challenging, right? All of the clinicians who are listening know that this is the most difficult thing that we have to do. Clinical diagnoses, they're messy. Patients sometimes come to us, quote, pre-diagnosed. Diagnoses, even when erroneous, are often perpetuated. I can remember a crazy circumstance where an individual had been hospitalized, and when you look at the medical record, they talked about this person having had a BKA bilateral, and yet you could see feet on the individual, and what there was a typo because the patient had had numerous admissions for diabetic ketoacidosis. So there are just, you know, gaffes like that. And when so there's lots of those kinds of problems in that process. But even when we get it right, you think about asthma, it's an especially challenging condition because diagnostic standards and definitions change over time. And it's a dynamic disease. People go through different levels of severity. And we know about, at least in kids and adolescents who so-called grow out of their asthma. So I think that this is especially challenging. And the point that this study makes is that it's good to go back and revisit diagnoses, especially for chronic intermittent conditions like this that have challenges and other conditions that might mimic it.
I can think of three cases that I've seen off the top of my head of misdiagnosis. One was a young teen who clearly had panic disorder. The second was another 20-year-old woman who had an AV malformation that I detected by a large murmur on her back. And the third was an older gentleman who had pulmonary fibrosis and not asthma. So you will find these cases. Pay attention.
Yeah, and especially when we have a pretty mobile society like the U.S. where folks, as you said, come to us pre-diagnosed, it's always worth having a bit of a critical eye. And another good example of that is GERD, where people will be on GERD medications for years and years and years, and circumstances may change, and maybe they still need it, but maybe they don't. So we need to think about that. And I think somebody mentioned histoplasmosis or blasto, but CDC, I'm actually on a panel that's helping develop an algorithm guideline for blasto and histo because the pulmonologists at least feel like it's underdiagnosed by primary care physicians in patients with community-acquired pneumonia that isn't responding. So it's always worth to rethink that diagnosis if things aren't going exactly as you expect. Okay, I am dying to hear the answer here because I think I got it wrong. As one of the founding members of Poland. Go ahead, Henry.
All right. So the question was, which of the following statements about poems is true? A, the poets are all family physicians. B, the poets exhaustively search PubMed and other databases each month. C, the idea for poems was born in a bar. And D, since the very beginning, each poem has been peer-reviewed. Well, three of the original four poets are family physicians, and the fourth is a pharmacist who is embedded in a family medicine residency. We have added two additional poets to the team. One is a family physician, and the other is a hospitalist. Each poet is responsible for a specific set of journals, typically 20 to 25, for I think there's about 110, maybe more, that we cover each year. And we survey those to identify the original research that we then critically summarize. Each poem undergoes a rigorous editorial review by independent research methodologists at the University of Missouri and by editorial staff who ensure the clarity of each poem. But the review by the folks from the University of Missouri was a late, I think we were doing those for about 5 or 10 years before we added them. It turns out that the original poets, Alan Shaughnessy, Dave Slauson, Mark, and I, met at a hotel bar in Houston during an STFM conference. We discovered some mutual interests, and we hatched this original idea for poems. So, at least in my recollection, the correct answer is C. So, Mark, what did I mess up?
Yeah, so I've always thought of the Missouri folks as peer review, but you're right. I think in the very early days, we didn't have the benefit of that. It was, but for over 20 years, and we really appreciate the folks at the University of Missouri Family Medicine Program who just do a great job every month, diligently reviewing, giving us great feedback, making every poem better, catching us when we screw up, which is monthly, daily. And we really can't thank them enough for all they do. And then the great editorial team at Wiley, Maria Vlasic has been our editor for well over 20 years. And keep an eye out in the next month or so. You should see another top 20 poems article in American Family Physician that Roland Grad and I have written. And anyway, we hope you keep listening to us. So thanks, everybody, for listening today. 100 down, many 100 to go, hopefully. Here's the URL for getting the CME credit, IAFP.com. Go to their education webpage. They're accredited by the ACCME to give us CME credit. And I hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends. Subscribe. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.
One final advertisement here. Kate Henry and I will be appearing at Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians meeting on April 26th in Maple Grove. So if you love the poems, please sign up and come meet us. We'd love to see you. So April 24th, Maple Grove, Minnesota, Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. See you there, Henry and Kate.
Looking forward to it.
April 22nd.
Great reminder. Well, I hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.
April 22nd. Apologies.
Editing magic. Oh, God. Okay. April 22nd. Okay, let's redo this entire thing.
I'm going to two different dates, and they were both wrong.
Type these things in ahead of time. It's okay. Okay. Stop. 3, 2, 1. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. John, you have an announcement to make?
Yes, there is a CME Conference of Essential Evidence and Poems in Maple Grove, Minnesota on April 26th. Kate Henry and I will be there, and we hope to see April 26th.
Fuck. Okay, start over. Stop. Write these things down, John.
It's like that progressive insurance guy, you know, the ad. Okay.
Yeah,
just give me one more chance. One more chance.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. John has a special announcement for us.
Yes, Kate, Henry, and I will be making a CME presentation in Maple Grove, Minnesota on April 22nd. So we hope to see you there.
Great. Well, that should be a good class. We do other classes throughout the year, and we'll make sure we let you know when they're coming up. We're going to be going to Arizona in the fall, I think. Is that right, John?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think French Lick, Indiana in the summer. We'll put those announcements up. The IAFP can give you CME credit if you want. Go to IAFP.com and click on their education webpage. They're accredited by the ACCME to give that credit out legally. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, subscribe, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates. Okay. I will get my editing done.